She pretended to be ugly for 3 years to avoid marriage, but the Alpha King saw through her lie. Her grandmother used to say, "A candle does not become less bright by hiding under a bowl. It only sets the bowl on fire." Maren Ashvile had always thought she understood that saying. She had nodded at it the way you nod at weather, acknowledging it, never believing it might apply to you. She was 18 when she first tucked her hair beneath a dirty linen cap and smudged ash along her jaw. She was 18 when she became invisible by choice, and she told herself it was wisdom. She kept a small thing in her apron pocket through all 3 years of the lie. A river-smoothed piece of amber her grandmother had pressed into her palm the week before she died. "When you are lost," the old woman had said, "hold this and remember that something beautiful can be formed by pressure, and time, and the willingness to wait." Maren had never planned to wait forever. She had only planned to wait until it was safe. She had not counted on the Alpha King arriving ahead of schedule, or on the fact that he would look at her ash-smudged face and see, with terrible, inconvenient clarity, exactly who she was. Chapter 1. The Terms of Invisibility. The village of Crest Hollow sat at the folded edge of the Ashen Moor, where the pine forest breathed cold even in summer, and the wolves ran deep and unseen in the dark between the trees. It was the kind of place that powerful men forgot about until they needed something from it. Labor, grain, daughters. Maren had understood the third category before she turned 16. Her stepfather, Aldrich Voss, was not a cruel man in the way villains in stories were cruel. He was something quieter and more persistent. A man who saw women as columns in a ledger. He had married her mother for the Ashvale land deed, and had been deeply inconvenienced when her mother died, leaving behind a daughter he had not budgeted for. The solution, to his mind, was obvious. Maren was young. Maren was, on the rare occasions she washed her face and let her dark hair down, startlingly lovely in the way of her mother's line. High cheekbones, wide gray eyes, a mouth built for expressions Aldrich found unsettling in a girl who owned nothing. Lovely daughters could be contracted. Lovely daughters solved the debt problem. She had overheard him discussing terms with a land broker from the eastern provinces. The man had laughed, a wet, satisfied sound. Send her portrait in the spring. Maren had gone to her grandmother's grave that same evening and sat in the grass until the cold came up through the ground and into her bones. The ash had been her own idea. The cap. The deliberate slouch she practiced until her shoulders curved inward, like parentheses. She borrowed a pair of her stepfather's cracked spectacles, the lenses so thick they made her gray eyes swim and distort, and wore them every day until she forgot the weight. She let her hands roughen. She cultivated a sniffle in cold weather. She became, in the accounting of Crest Hollow, plain Maren, the washwoman's helper who smelled of lye and spoke too softly to be worth addressing. Aldrich, for his part, had looked at her one morning over the breakfast table and said with genuine bewilderment, "You have grown plain, girl." He had sounded almost sorrowful, the sorrow of a man watching an investment depreciate. Then he had gone back to his bread and forgotten her. That had been 3 years ago. She had been surviving the forgetting ever since, which was a different thing entirely from living, but which kept her out of a contract she had not signed. She had one friend in the village, Sable Dunmore, the miller's youngest daughter, who was wolf-born and gold-hearted, and who knew about the ash because she had been there the night Maren invented it. Sable kept the secret with the ferocity of someone protecting something sacred, and in return Maren helped her with the flower accounts, because Maren had a gift with numbers that years of ash could not obscure. "The king's convoy is coming through," Sable told her one morning in the mill, her voice pitched low, eyes bright with something between excitement and warning. "Not just scouts, him, the Alpha King Corvin Duskmore himself. They say he's choosing a new regional warden, and he wants to inspect the border settlements personally." Maren kept her eyes on the ledger. "That has nothing to do with me." "He travels with a court physician and two treaty scribes. They're staying 3 nights at the weighhouse." Sable pressed her palms to the flower-dusty counter. "Maren, if Aldrich sees an opportunity, I will be busy." Marin turned a page. I am always busy. Busy and plain and very forgettable. Sable looked at her for a long moment, the look of someone who had watched a person hold their breath underwater for years and was beginning to worry about the lungs. I don't know how much longer you can hold it. Marin touched the amber in her apron pocket. Smooth. Warm from her body heat. Pressure and time and the willingness to wait. A little longer, she said. Just a little longer. Chapter 2. The Alpha King arrives. Corvin Duskmore rode into Crest Hollow on a gray horse the color of storm clouds, and the village arranged itself around his arrival, the way iron filings arrange themselves around a magnet, involuntary, immediate, and revealing of hidden orientations. Marin watched from the corner of the Wayhouse yard, a bucket of wash water at her feet, and allowed herself the brief luxury of honest observation. He was larger than rumor had made him, broad through the chest in a way that suggested structural intent rather than bulk, with dark hair cut close at the sides, and a jaw that seemed designed to make difficult decisions look effortless. His eyes, when he swept them across the assembled villagers, were a pale, rain-washed amber. She looked away immediately. Pale amber eyes were the eyes of a wolf who could see, not just look. She knew enough about alpha wolves to know that their sight was not purely physical. They read truth the way other creatures read weather. She kept her head down, shoulders curved, spectacles firmly in place. Aldrich had positioned himself at the front of the welcoming cluster, beaming in his best coat, which still had the faint ghost of a stain on the left lapel. Marin watched him peripherally and felt the familiar cold calculus of his attention, his eyes scanning the crowd, checking that she was present but suitably obscured. He had not tried to contract her in 2 years. He had simply filed her under lost asset and moved on to other schemes. The Alpha King dismounted with an economy of motion that Marin found, against her will, rather beautiful. His warden commander, a tall woman with close-cropped silver hair and the bearing of a cathedral, began exchanging formal words with the village council. The king himself stepped back from the ceremony, and something in his posture shifted, the formal weight of kingship briefly set aside, replaced by a quiet, intent watchfulness. His gaze moved across the crowd. It stopped on Marin. She felt it the way you feel a sunbeam cross your face when you are trying to sleep in a dark room. Specific, unwelcome, and impossible to ignore. She did not look up. She picked up her bucket and turned to walk away. Hold! His voice was not loud. It did not need to be. She stopped. The word had not been a request. She turned slowly and looked in his direction without quite meeting his eyes, a technique she had perfected, the appearance of compliance without the exposure of direct contact. The king was looking at her with an expression she could not immediately categorize. Not interest exactly, not dismissal, something more careful than either.
Your name, he said. Marin, your majesty.
She kept her voice flat, roughened by 2 seasons of deliberate vocal habits.
Washwoman's help.
He nodded slowly, as if she had confirmed something, and then, mercifully, his warden commander called his name and the moment ended. He turned away, the crowd around Marin exhaled. Marin carried her bucket to the laundry and stood over it for a long time, her hands braced on the rim, her heartbeat loud in her own ears. He had stopped on her. Out of 30 bodies in that yard, he had stopped on her. She took the amber from her pocket and held it until her pulse quieted. Just a little longer, she told herself. He will be gone in 3 days. Chapter 3. What Sharp Eyes Find. He was not gone in 3 days. On the morning of the 4th day, his warden commander announced that a suspected treaty violation had been discovered in the forest deeds of the Ashenmoor border, deeds that apparently required careful local testimony to untangle. The convoy would remain a further week. Marin learned this from Sable, who delivered the news with an expression that managed to be both sympathetic and slightly fascinated. Also, Sable added, he has been asking about you. The amber pressed into Marin's palm through the apron fabric. What do you mean, asking? He asked the wayhousekeeper who the woman with the spectacles was. The keeper told him you were Aldrich Voss's ward. Aldrich told him, Sable hesitated. Aldrich told him you were simple, touched, not suitable for conversation. The cold that moved through Marin's chest was not the cold of the moor. It was the specific cold of being erased by someone who stood to benefit from your erasure. She had known Aldrich was capable of it. She had simply not expected to feel the confirmation like a blade. Then the matter is settled, she said. He has been told I am not worth speaking to. Marin, he didn't look like a man who was satisfied with that answer. She found out what kind of man he was the following afternoon. She was in the Wayhouse herb garden, on her knees in the dirt, harvesting late-season lavender that the keeper had asked her to cut and bundle. The work was solitary. The garden was behind a stone wall that shielded it from the main yard. She had believed herself alone. You're left-handed, said a voice above and behind her, but you cut with your right. That means you've trained yourself to use your non-dominant hand so that your handwriting isn't recognized. She did not startle. She had been a person in hiding long enough to school her body against visible reactions. She set down the shears slowly and looked over her shoulder. The Alpha King was standing at the garden wall, arms folded loosely, watching her with those pale amber eyes that were, she noted with despair, every bit as perceptive as she had feared. Your Majesty. She stood, brushing dirt from her skirt, keeping her shoulders curved. You were looking at the ledger in the mill yard 2 days ago, he said. From 40 feet away, I saw you turn a page and pause at a column. Then you went back and corrected a number without rereading the entry above it. You had the error memorized. Marin said nothing. Numbers had always lived in her mind with unusual clarity. She had never thought it particularly visible. Your stepfather says you are simple. He let the word sit in the air between them like an object he was inviting her to examine. I have known a great many simple people. They are not capable of double-entry corrections from memory. I surprise people sometimes. Her voice was carefully flat. I am sure you do. He came around the garden wall and into the space beside her, and she had the sudden vertiginous sensation of the air itself rearranging, the particular gravity that alphas of his magnitude carried, the way the world seemed to tilt slightly toward them. I also notice that you flinch whenever your stepfather's name is spoken. Not from fear of him, specifically. From something colder. The flinch of a person who has been calculating against a threat for a long time. You notice a great deal, Your Majesty. It's a professional requirement. He was watching her profile. She was staring at the lavender. May I ask you something plainly? She turned and looked at him then, fully, directly, in the way she had avoided for 3 days. A mistake. His eyes met hers, and she felt the contact like pressure, like the moment before a storm breaks. The spectacles, he said quietly. You don't need them. Her heart was completely still. The prescription is decorative, he continued. Glass, not ground lens. And the ash on your jaw is almost perfectly applied, but not quite. There's a line below your left ear where the skin is a different shade. The garden was very quiet. A bee moved through the lavender. Marin could hear her own breathing. What do you want? She said at last, and her voice had lost the careful roughness, and she heard herself sound like herself for the first time in 3 years, low and clear and frightened. Something in his face changed. Not triumph, not the satisfaction of a man who had caught something. Something softer and more complicated. Something that looked disconcertingly like relief. I haven't decided yet, he said honestly. But I would like to know your actual name. Not the name you gave me in the yard. Your name. That was my actual name. Marin Ashfall. Ashfall. He repeated it as if testing the weight of it. The land deeds in dispute. The Ashenmoor Forest deeds. One of them has that name. The cold returned. She looked at him carefully. Those were my mother's lands. Transferred to Aldrich Voss upon her marriage. Transferred. He said. Or taken. She had no answer that wouldn't destroy her carefully constructed invisibility, Or perhaps she did, and the destruction was already underway, and there was nothing left to do but let it burn. Chapter 4. The Shape of a Scheme. He came back to the herb garden the following morning, and the morning after that. Marin did not encourage this. She also did not leave, a fact she examined honestly, and decided was due partly to pragmatism and partly to something she was not ready to name. He brought no retinue, no ceremony. He sat on the garden wall with his long legs folded, and she knelt in the dirt. And they talked. He told her things she had not expected a king to say plainly. That the border disputes were more tangled than his scribes had anticipated. That he suspected at least 3 of the Ashenmore land transfers had been conducted under duress or deception during the years of the Grey Fever, when the Moor villages had been too sick and too exhausted to notice their deeds changing hands. That he had traveled personally, precisely because treaty violations of that kind needed a witness with authority, and that authority was a thing that had to be physically present to mean anything. "You knew before you came," Marin said one morning, looking up from the lavender she was still not quite bundling. "About the deeds." "I suspected." He met her eyes without flinching. "Your village sent a petition 2 years ago. It arrived on my desk 6 months later, delayed by 3 separate administrative layers. I suspect those delays were not accidental." She thought about Aldrich's careful maintenance of connections, his trips to the provincial capital, the way certain decisions always seemed to resolve in his direction. "He is not," she said slowly, "a man who leaves things to chance." "Neither," said the king, "am I." He told her his name on the 3rd morning, not his title, but the name his mother had used, the name that lived inside the formality of Corvin Duskmore, Alpha King of the Ashen Reaches, like a smaller, quieter creature. "Rin," he said, "when there are no scribes." She did not use it immediately, but she held it the same way she held the amber, carefully, aware of its warmth. On the afternoon of the 5th day, he brought her a piece of paper. A transfer record, her mother's land deed, bearing Aldrich Voss's signature and a notary seal she did not recognize. "That seal is false," he said. "The notary whose name appears on it died the year before this transfer was dated." Marin looked at the document for a long time. The numbers on it. The dates. Her mother's name at the top in the careful handwriting of a woman who had believed she was arranging security for her daughter. She pressed her thumbnail against the amber through the apron fabric, hard enough to leave a crescent mark. "What happens now?" she asked. "Now," he said, "I would very much like you to speak to my treaty scribes." A pause. "And I would like you to consider removing the ash." She looked at him. The pale amber eyes were steady, not commanding, asking. "You haven't asked me why," she said. "Why I did it. I know why." His voice was quiet. "I have watched Aldrich Voss look at you 2 times in 5 days. Both times he looked for about 3 seconds and looked away. He has filed you under not useful. The disguise is working." Another pause. "What I find more interesting is that you are clearly capable of managing without it, and you have simply chosen not to be seen rather than to be seen and fight." "Fighting requires allies," she said. "I had none." He looked at her for a moment with something in his face that moved through several expressions too quickly for her to catch each one. Then he said, "You have one now." So simply that she almost believed it. Chapter 5. Fire Under the Bowl. Aldrich Voss requested an audience with the Alpha King on the 6th day of the extended stay. He arrived in his good coat, stain rehidden by strategic tailoring, and presented himself as a cooperative local landowner who was very eager to assist with the treaty investigation, and who had perhaps prepared a modest gift basket. Marin was not in the room. She was in the adjacent antechamber, sitting very still at a small desk where the king's senior treaty scribe, a sharp-faced woman named Oriel Vex, who wore 7 rings and had a memory like a steel trap, was asking her questions about dates, names, and numbers with the intensity of someone building a structure one careful piece at a time. She could hear Aldrich's voice through the thin wall. The performance of cooperative innocence, each word placed like a stone to guide water away from truth. She answered Scribe Vex's questions in her real voice. She had been using it for 2 days now, growing back into it the way a limb recovers from numbness, with intermittent pins and needles and a deep, astonished gratitude. She recited figures. She described the year the gray fever had killed her mother in 3 weeks, and left a child of 15 with a stepfather who had immediately begun discussing land management with off-village brokers. She described the notary's seal she had seen on her mother's will, which was different from the seal on the transfer document. She described the amber, her grandmother's, given to her mother, now pressed into her palm throughout the telling, like a compass. Scribe Vex wrote without pausing, rings clicking softly against the pen shaft. At the end, the scribe looked up at her over the ledger. "You have a remarkable memory. Numbers remember themselves," Marin said. "I just have to listen." In the next room, Aldrich's voice had shifted register, higher, slightly faster. The king was asking questions that a cooperative landowner would prefer not to answer. Marin folded her hands in her lap and waited. The amber was smooth and warm between her palms. When the door between the rooms opened, it was the king's warden commander who came through, the silver-haired woman whose name was Petra Sorn, and who had the air of someone who had waited a very long time for someone else to arrive at the obvious conclusion. "He's asking for you," Warden Sorn told Marin. "Not Aldrich. The king." Marin stood, straightened her spine to its full height, a height she had hunched away from for 3 years, and walked through the door. Aldrich's face, when he saw her, went through 4 expressions in 2 seconds. Recognition came last, and with it a white, unsteady fear. He was looking at her the way people look at a fire that has escaped the hearth, aware, suddenly, of where it had been contained and what that containment had cost. She did not look at him for long. She looked at the king, who was standing behind the interview table with his arms at his sides and his pale amber eyes on her face, and she realized with a start that she had not put the ash on that morning. She had looked at the jar of it on her shelf and simply not reached for it. She was wearing her own face, her mother's cheekbones and her grandmother's gray eyes, and a mouth that had spent 3 years flattened and was now, quietly, doing something else. Aldrich said her name in a voice scraped raw by disbelief. She addressed the king. "I have given Scribe Vex the dates of the original deed registration. If you cross-reference against the provincial death records for the notary named..." "We have." His voice was calm. "Voss, you are under provisional land fraud detention pending review by the Ashen Court. Commander Sorn will explain the terms." Aldrich's chair scraped back. There was noise, protest, bargaining, the ugly grammar of a man realizing that the walls he built have become a room he is locked inside. Marin stepped to the side and let the warden handle it, which the warden did with the patient efficiency of someone who had been waiting for exactly this. When Aldrich was gone, the room was very quiet. "He called you simple," the king said. "He needed me to be." She smoothed her apron. The amber was in her pocket. It was easier than the alternative. What was the alternative? "Seeing me." The king was quiet for a moment. Then, "I see you." He said it the way her grandmother had said important things, not loudly, but with a weight that meant the words would live somewhere afterward and keep working. She looked at him. He looked at her. Outside, the Ashenmoor pines exhaled their cold green breath, and somewhere a wolf howled once, distant and clear, like a bell. Chapter 6. The Unlayering. She washed the ash off properly that evening, in the weighhouse basin, with water that steamed in the autumn cold. She watched it go down the drain in small gray spirals. The woman in the water's surface looked back at her, familiar and strange at once, like a word you have known all your life, but suddenly noticed the shape of. Sable arrived at the basin's edge and simply looked at her for a long moment, eyes bright. "There you are," she said, and her voice had the quality of something found. After being lost so long, the searching had begun to feel like the point. They sat together on the weighhouse step until the stars came out over the Ashen Moor, and Marin told Sable everything that had happened in the antechamber, and Sable told Marin that the village had been talking since the commander escorted Aldrich out, and that the talking had the specific stunned character of people revising a story they thought they already knew. "They'll feel guilty," Sable said. "Some of them." "I don't need their guilt." Marin leaned her head back against the weighhouse wall. "I need the land deed." "Do you think he can actually?" "I think he already has." A pause. "He had the records before he arrived, Sable. He came here for this. He just needed testimony to make it court legal." Sable was quiet a moment. "He came for the land dispute, but he kept coming back to the herb garden." Marin said nothing, which was itself a kind of answer. The following morning, Scribe Vex delivered a formal court document bearing the king's seal. The Ashvale land transfer declared void on grounds of notarial fraud. The holdings of the eastern Ashenmoor parcel returned to Marin Ashvale as surviving heir. It was 3 pages of precise legal language that added up, in plain terms, to "it was always yours." Marin held the document and pressed the amber against her sternum, through the apron fabric, with her free hand, and did not cry, which required extraordinary effort. The king found her in the herb garden. She had begun to think of it as the one honest room in Crest Hollow, and he looked at her face without ash, or spectacles, or curvature, in the particular light of a late autumn morning, and said nothing for long enough that a different kind of silence grew between them. The kind that has texture. "There is a position," he said finally, "at the Ashen Court. Treaty records clerk. The previous holder retired last winter. It requires an exceptional memory for numbers and dates." His voice was careful, the way careful voices are when they are carrying more than the words can actually hold. "It would require relocating to Waldenmere, the capital." She looked at him steadily. "You are offering me a job." "I am offering you several things," he said, "and using the job as a way of making the other things seem less alarming." "What are the other things?" He looked at her with those amber eyes, which she had stopped trying to avoid.
"The chance to be seen," he said. "Entirely. Without ash. Without the cap. Without..." A gesture that took in the history of the pretense, the 3 years, the cracked spectacles still sitting on her shelf upstairs, the gray spirals in the drain. "I would like to know you, Marin Ashvale. Properly. If you are willing to be known." She thought about what it had cost to be invisible. She thought about the bowl her grandmother had described, and the candle inside it, and what had happened when the bowl could no longer contain the heat. "I am told," she said, measuring each word, "that I set things on fire." He blinked, and then he smiled. A real smile, private and sudden, the kind that must live most of its life behind more controlled expressions. And it transformed his face into something she had not expected, something warm and a little undone. "I am counting on it," he said. She reached into her apron pocket and closed her fingers around the amber. "Ask me properly," she said. "Not the job, the other things." He did. Chapter 7, What Remains. The remaining days in Crest Hollow moved with the quality of things that know they are endings. The convoy prepared. Scribe Vex organized the case documents with her 7-ringed precision. Warden Sorn managed the legal handover of Aldrich's provisional detainment to the provincial authorities. The village continued its collective revision. Marin packed her room. It did not take long. She had, deliberately and by necessity, accumulated almost nothing in 3 years. Her mother's shawl, dark blue wool with a silver border. The cracked spectacles. These she almost left, and then she didn't, because they were part of the story of who she had been, and she had decided to carry that story without shame. The amber. Sable came to help, and mostly sat on the edge of the bed and talked, which was its own form of help. They had made arrangements. Sable's mill was within the restored Ashvale landholdings, and the legal documentation now gave her family proper tenure rather than Aldrich's revocable tolerance. This had made Sable's father cry in the way that large, flower-dusted men do when they are overwhelmed, briefly, forcefully, and never to be mentioned again. "You'll write?" Sable said. It was not a question. "Numbers and dates are my medium," Marin said,
folding the shawl. But I think I can manage letters. And him? Sable asked with the directness of a lifelong friend who has earned every question. Marin smoothed the shawl's silver border. Him, she said, is a separate accounting. On the morning of departure, the village gathered again in the weighhouse yard, the same 30 bodies, the same involuntary magnetic arrangement around the convoy. But the arrangement was different this time. People looked at Marin. Not through her, not past her, not with the comfortable blankness that invisibility invites. At her. Several looked away quickly, carrying the hot flush of the newly accountable. She stood with her small bag and her straight spine and let herself be looked at, because that was the whole point. The king fell into step beside her as the convoy organized. He did not offer his arm. They were not yet the kind of story where that was assumed. But he walked beside her at a distance that was specific and deliberate, a proximity that said, chosen. Ready? He said. She touched the amber in her pocket, thought of her grandmother's voice, thought of 3 years under the bowl, and the heat that had been building, and what it felt like to finally, finally let it out. I have been ready, she said, for a very long time. Epilogue. 1 year later, Waldenmeer. The treaty clerk's office in Waldenmeer occupied a turret room with three arched windows that looked east over the city's rooftops to where the Ashen Moor's distant tree line was a faint, dark stroke against the horizon. On mornings when the light came in at the right angle, Marin's amber glowed on the window ledge like a small, trapped sun. She kept it there now, in the open, where she could see it while she worked. She had stopped keeping it in her pocket on the day she realized she no longer needed to hold on to it in emergencies, that the warmth it represented had become distributed through her life rather than concentrated in a single small piece of carried hope. But she could not quite bring herself to put it away. She suspected she never would. The treaty clerk's office was also, incidentally, where the Alpha King tended to appear on the pretext of reviewing documents that did not strictly require his personal attention. This had become so well understood by the court staff that the appearance of Corvin Duskmore in the hallway outside the turret room now served as a reliable indicator of his actual location to anyone seeking an audience. Not the throne room, not the war chamber, but the place where a woman with gray eyes and a gift for numbers was building a new archive of the Ashen Reach's eastern border settlements. Sable had written 3 letters in the past year, each one longer than the last, each one containing at least one piece of news that made Marin put the letter down and look out the window for a while. The mill was doing well. The restored Ashval lands had been planted with winter rye and were already recovering their old productivity. Aldrich had been found guilty of 4 counts of fraudulent transfer at the Ashen Court and was presently engaged in the very boring work of paying reparations, which Marin found more satisfying than anything dramatic would have been. The 4th letter had arrived that morning. Sable was expecting a child in the spring. She had included a dried sprig of Crest Hollow lavender, which Marin had pressed between 2 ledger pages immediately and would probably keep forever. Corvin arrived at the turret room in the late afternoon when the light was amber golden and specific. He had stopped pretending about the documents around month 3. He came because she was there, and he said so without ceremony, which she had decided was her favorite thing about him. She showed him the letter. He read it standing beside her desk, close enough that she could feel the warmth of him, the particular gravity that she had once described to Sable as inconvenient and had long since reclassified. "She wants you at the birth," he observed, setting the letter down. "She wants Sable things to be witnessed by people who love her." Marin looked at the amber on the windowsill, gold in the afternoon light. "She is not unreasonable." He leaned 1 hip against the edge of her desk in the way that still, after a year, made the room feel reorganized around him. "We could go in the spring. I have border settlements to review. Legitimately." "You have border settlements to review every 4 months," she said mildly. "The Eastern Ashen Moor requires significant administrative attention." "The Eastern Ashen Moor has 19 families and a mill. A very important mill." He picked up the amber from the windowsill, turned it in his fingers. The light moved through it in slow, gold waves. You never told me where this came from. She looked at the amber in his hands, her grandmother's amber, 3 years in her apron pocket, now warm from the windowsill and warm from him, glowing between his fingers like a held flame. My grandmother, she said. She told me something beautiful can be formed by pressure, and time, and the willingness to wait. A pause. She also said a candle does not become less bright by hiding under a bowl. It only sets the bowl on fire. He turned the amber once more, watching the light inside it. She was right, he said. About both. He set the amber back on the windowsill. Then he turned and offered her his hand. Not with the gravity of a king demanding attendance, but with the simple, straightforward asking of a man who wanted to walk somewhere with a woman he loved and was not interested in pretending otherwise. She had been ready for a long time. But she thought, looking at his amber eyes, and the amber on the ledge, and the evening coming gold and slow through the arched windows of a room she had made entirely her own, that ready was not quite the right word. Arrived, she thought. I have arrived. She took his hand. The amber glowed behind them as they left the room, small and golden and warm as a held flame, evidence for anyone who cared to look that something beautiful had been formed here. By pressure. By time. By a woman who had finally, at last, let herself be seen. End.